I went to college in St. Paul, Minnesota, to Bethel College, and I became aware of a group of people, of students from the university in Hamlin and some other schools that were meeting for a Bible study. And so I began to meet with them as well. And there was such a caring among those people. And as time went on, near the end of that school year, people said, well, how about if next school year we form a household and live together? Well, my parents went through the roof and said, no way are you going to live in a house with other college-age men. No way. So I said, okay. And I prayed and I said, I believe that if this is what I'm supposed to do, that my parents' mind will be changed. And so I went off to California to work as the wilderness director at a camp. And about 3 weeks before school was to start, I found out that my housing arrangements had fallen through. So I didn't have anywhere to live that I thought of when I would go back to college. So I called up my parents and said, listen, I just don't have any place to live. But they're still asking me if I want to join this community. So my parents said, all right, well, you know, we're just going to trust you. Because I told them it was a duplex situation. The men would be upstairs and the women would be downstairs. And so that was my first experience. And there were 15 of us. And we shared our meals. And we shared our lives very intensively. When I think about that, we were all going to school at that time. Many of us were in graduate school at that time. And we had prayer every morning at 6 o'clock, and I can remember coming out in my robe and just trying to stay awake. And we would have meetings every evening. We would go down to the Nicollet Mall, if some of you have been familiar with Minneapolis, and we would sing. And we would have soccer games on Wednesdays. This was in the summertime, and we got to know a lot of street people. Minneapolis has lots of street people. And we became a ministry house. Well, then more and more people wanted to live with us, but we couldn't have that many people living in our house, so we started to fill up the apartment building next door until there were 25 people every night eating together for dinner, and it got a little bit ridiculous. So what we decided was we were putting out about $1,800 a month in rent with all these apartments and this large house that we had, so we decided we would buy a house. So we bought a house, and I'm going to zip through the story, and Daryl and I got married, and we moved to St. Paul, and we had a community house together where we lived upstairs and three single fellows lived downstairs. And as time went on, this Bible study became filling up the whole week with activities, so we decided that we would consider ourselves what actually was, hello?
Hi.
We discovered that we were acting as the church. So we began to function as what might be considered a non-denominational church, which is how it is today. And there are a number of households. I'll talk a little bit more about community later, but Then Daryl and I moved to Sioux Falls. I had been part of this community for about 5 years and realized that living in as intensive as an experience that we were living in, I realized that I needed to make some distinctions between my theological beliefs and what I saw as my idea and my conception of who I was as a Christian. Was so tied up with this group that I needed what I call a sabbatical. And so with the love and support of the whole community, Daryl and I moved to Sioux Falls. Daryl, at that time I was pregnant, and Daryl and I had been totally sharing. I worked half-time, he worked half-time, so that we both could be doing other things. And the college that he was teaching at that time did not have a full-time opening. So in what I would call God's providence, the next week we were told there was an opening. The president of the college in Sioux Falls called and said, do you have somebody interested in joining the art department? And so we moved to Sioux Falls. And what I thought was going to be a one-year endeavor and one-year sabbatical and come back to all my family and friends has turned out to be 3.5 years. So I found a huge gap in my life. I had been part of this intensive, what I would call, quote, family, we weren't related, but family experience, going to Sioux Falls where I didn't know a soul. It was a very devastating experience. I cried for 2 weeks straight every night after dinner. That was kind of my ritual. And I would
instead
call.
Instead of a bath, huh?
Yeah, right. Instead of a bath, I cried. And I got a very large phone bill because I would call my friends all the time. Well, then I began to meet some women who called themselves feminists. Well, feminism, oh, that was a big red flag for me at that time in my life. But they were just fascinating women. And I was, if some of you have been to any of the other sessions, I've been talking about the hunger issue, and I was getting kind of a community of friends through working on the hunger issue. And one day I got a phone call from a woman who said, I need you to go to a food pantry meeting because I want to go to this meeting of some women who are interested in talking about biblical feminism. I said, well, I don't want to go to that meeting. I want to come to your meeting. And so I did, and that was the start of a support group that is the picture that I have passed around, because this is, you know, how everybody, you know, gloating grandparents want to show pictures of their family. Well, I like to show pictures of my support group, which I consider my family. And we began meeting, and this doesn't often happen, because I've been in a lot of groups which are supposed to be for support for different reasons, but this group clicked. Have you ever been with a group of people or one person and you get in a conversation and it's just like the chemistry is right? Well, I've never been a part of a group where the chemistry has been right between six people immediately, and that's just what happened. And we started out in talking about biblical feminism and what it meant to be a Christian and a feminist. And the group is still going 2.5 years later, and what has evolved is, because the women were so excited about what was happening, the husbands started to meet. So now there is a counterpart of husbands that meet of these women who join together in the morning and share. Now I want to talk just a little bit more on an abstract level about support groups. I see support groups functioning in a vital role today because I see a real breakdown of the extended family. How many of you live within, let's say, an hour radius of more than five members of your immediate family, of which I would consider parents or brothers and sisters?
What, more than an hour?
Like within 100, let's say an hour. You could get to their house in an hour, so you could go in a day and come back in a day. So there's three. That's not very many people. Gerald and I would have to travel 2 days to get to any member of our immediate family. And we don't like that, but that's how our lives are. And so we have a need for family. And I know that for some people that might include aunts and uncles, and maybe if I extended it to that, that would include more of you. But I see that with the breakdown and the high mobility rate of people who are living in the United States, we have a need for intimacy. And I think that I'm going to be projecting some of my own personal Jenny Wood Nelson theories here, but I've come to the conclusion that one of the reasons I think that there's such a breakdown in marriage is because we expect within the small nucleus of people to be able to work out the problems of being human and relationship together. And that's an incredibly large burden, I feel, to place on two people, or let's say if the children are involved, a unit to expect to work out their problems together. And so I think that, you know, before you were able to have the family there for support, for help, for counsel, for perhaps arbitrating parties if you needed a third person to be able to help work things out. And so I see, if for no other reason, a support group is just vital in being able to help us to work out our struggles, process our goals, and for intimacy. When I first got married, I'm going to shut this door. There's a shortwave radio in here. When I first got married, I had the illusion that my husband was supposed to be able to meet all of my needs. And that was quickly dispelled. And I realized I had a need for other friends that were very intimate, and that I was sharing intimate problems, goals, dreams with. And for myself, as a woman, I have the need to be sharing with women, because I think there are unique differences between men and women. I think they're equal, but I think they are different. And so I think groups can arise out of a lot of different needs and can be fulfilled in different ways, but I am of the firm opinion that support groups are vitally needed in the secular community as well as the church. So I'm just going to put down just say a few groups that I have been part of, groups that just meet for a study purpose. I've been part of many hunger groups where we'll meet over a common goal or interest in the hunger issue, in the nuclear issue. And what seems to happen is, as you study a book or whatever, that you're sharing your lives as well. We can't dichotomize our lives in what we're involved in. It's all so interconnected. A group to process goals. That's one of the things that our group does, as my support group does, is that a lot of the women in my group, I happen to be 28, but most all the other women in my group are over 35, and they're all going through a time of their life right now where their children are now in school and they have the opportunity to pursue other goals. And so we're processing a lot of goal-oriented types of things. What kind of job? What do I need to do? And being able to get together in a safe environment and talk about these things without people locking you into, well, you're going to do that. I mean, being able to change your mind every week. Well, I don't think I want to do that. I mean, it's very intimidating sometimes if you kind of say, well, I think I want to do that, and then people get that conception that you're going to do that, and then you change your mind. We processed for 4 weeks with a woman who wanted to go to medical school, and she went through the whole process and decided that it would have been too much of a too much for her family, that she wasn't willing to do that. And she said she was so glad she had a place where people weren't going to think she was a failure because she decided that she did not want to be a doctor. A group that has this to me is the best kind of group, and this is my own opinion, but a group that's set up for action reflection. We found after a year and a half of our support group, we needed to be doing something. So we have offered some sessions on support group. We'll have all of our members get together, and we'll go and we'll just talk about what it's meant to us. And that's a time where we can get together and have reflection together, and that intimacy, but also action in where we are going out into the community and offering something. Because I think there's something about a staleness that happens if you just get together and talk and talk and talk. At least I have the need then to have some sort of action connected with the reflection. I'd like to just kind of stop now. And I have other things I want to say, but I'd just like to know if there's any comments, any questions about what I've said now. If you're part of a group, what you have found has been an agreement of what I've said or disagreement?
I was just going to ask, what you just said, where you go out to groups, do you wait for an invitation, or do you pursue people to talk to tell about your support group?
Well, at first we kind of pursued it, but now it's more we have been getting asked to do it. People kind of, Sioux Falls isn't that large of a community, mm-hmm. so people get to know us. And you were going to say something over?
Well, really identified with your comment, Jenny, when you said that a group that gets together and just discusses can become very stale. We were part of a group where we all fell into that trap for a while, and pretty soon it became any issue that you just wanted to even struggle with within the group, you know, nobody wanted to touch, and so we had to move out and break up is what we found.
Mm-hmm. Because did you find that you almost thought you were just kind of spinning your wheels, like what was this really going to do if somehow if there isn't some sort of action? Mm. It doesn't even have to be a large, you know, world-shaking
action. Just a change in your everyday behavior of some type, but it got to be where if you wanted to struggle with something and look at it, nobody wanted to do that because it threatened the status.
Right.
And really it was shocking when we finally realized how stale we had become.
Did the group membership stay pretty much the same during that time?
There was, yes, it did. And there was a core that had been together for many years when we joined the group. Yeah. And that was probably the most difficult thing to overcome.
Yes.
Yeah.
You were going to say something?
I'd like to know more about the men's angle of the support groups and things like that.
Yes. Well, I think that I, there was a speaker here, and did any of you hear Carol Coeur? Well, anyway, she was a speaker here for 3 weeks, a month, as a matter of fact. And she said that her husband was part of a support group, but he would never call it a support group. He always called it a discussion group, because somehow she felt that men oftentimes have a need for it to be more goal-oriented. I mean, you can have an extreme where it has to be connected with something you're doing rather than just being. I think that what the, as far as in this example, with Daryl's support group, the three, okay, I should say too that one of the women was divorced, but two of the women's husbands decided not to be part of it. One couldn't because of scheduling, but the other one was just too overloaded. I should say too that there's a real high level of homogeneous interest in our group. Everyone is a professor except for one. So in some ways we're coming a lot from the same angle. But they found that all three of these men are what I would consider highly intellectual and very busy and very isolated. They found that they were seen high visibility people, maybe that's a good way to say it, but they didn't have anyone that they were sharing their fears with, their struggles with, and so this is the main goal of their group. They don't really get together and study a book or anything. They go every Monday morning at 7 o'clock, they meet at a local restaurant, and they just get together and they talk, because they are doing so much that they don't really have a need at this point. They might find that that might evolve. They haven't been meeting as long as we have. They've been meeting for about a year now. But they have more of a need to have a safe place where they can talk about the things that they're afraid about. That seems to be the main thing they talk about, is things that they have fears about, which I find delightful. And they need each other now. It's so wonderful. When one of the fellows was hospitalized for back problems this spring, they would just go over and meet in the hospital and just sit and talk and be able to cry with each other. And I think that hopefully now with the women's liberation, it's not only liberated women, but liberated men some, of being able to be real. And but I think there still is a lot of stigma to men crying, particularly men that are, these three particular men are in from, well, Daryl's 33 to 45, and supposed to look very confident and know what they're doing and how they're going to do it. And that's the main thing that they do. So I know there's a lot of other goals, but they found that when they began to talk with other men about this, one of the questions they would ask was, do you have an intimate male friend? Do do you have another man that you share intimately with? And they were finding within their colleagues that there weren't, that they were very surprised at how many of their colleagues were saying, I don't really have what I would consider an intimate friend. And I found that very surprising.
I'm interested in how something like this can evolve from within a church mm-hmm. community, because I've been in several churches and the women always say, well, the men need something. The men should have this. The men will maybe complain to their wives, but that's as far as it goes.
Yes.
And the women should not have to. I mean, it just doesn't work if they try to set up
a
breakfast meeting for the men because it's good for them.
Oh, we decided. We are all, I'll say one thing. All the women that you see in that picture are highly, we're all very verbal. But this was one thing that we just took a real passive role in. This was totally their initiative, because we knew if we did it, it would fall apart.
So you're talking to us about it isn't going to do anything.
Oh, no. I think that what happened was they saw we were so excited about it mm-hmm. that they said, well, we want something too. But you were saying about the church. I should go back to my community experience and explain how our church there function in support groups. We made a decision, okay, as people were getting married, we were a college group, all pretty, you know, flexible, could live in one room. But as we began getting married and having children, things really changed. And people weren't as comfortable with living under one roof. Daryl and I, very much included, we're moving back towards community, but we're probably not going to live under one roof with a bunch of other people. It's highly stressful. And we made a commitment to living within a geographical area. So now we have two major geographical areas that we live within. And the church is broken down into support groups. And those support groups meet once, we call them small groups, meet once a week. And they're broken down according to geographical areas so that if the church lives basically within a 2-mile radius, and then there's also another portion of the community that lives on a mainly on a college campus, and they have their own support group. Your care group is mainly within a walking distance, so you're not only being able to see each other. It's not hard to see each other. You can just walk over to each other's homes or a very short drive. And that group defines what it wants to do. And we found that different groups defined themselves quite differently. One group decided to, that particular group had a solidarity and interest in the nuclear issue, so they began to study. Sojourners puts out a packet that has to do with the faith and interest in the arms race. So they were studying that. Another group, some people within that group were having some emotional problems, so that they were dealing more on people sharing from their problems and goals. And those were all mixed. They were not just women and or men. They were all mixed. The problem you find with having that kind of group is you have a real diversity in interest. And I find that those kinds of groups sometimes are harder to get going, because there might be one person that's not at all interested in this particular issue, where there might be three or four who are. And you have to do a lot more arbitration in that kind of group. But I think that they have been incredibly successful. And what now the church has decided is, this is what they see as the base of the church. Their main goal is not to have big meetings, but their main goal is to be nurturing and providing a family atmosphere and care within those small groups. The small groups now have been defined as the main function of the church, because we've found that that's where people are getting their needs met, are processing. Like, what they do is, like, they'll have the sermon, and then people then can process the sermon also at the meeting. Because you find if you go to it and hear your sermon, you might have questions, but to try to do that in a large group sometimes is difficult. So that's been another one of the functions. And also the logistics of the church and questions that people have. There are what's called body meetings, or what you probably would call church business meetings. Most of the business of the church is also done at those meetings. If there's an issue of the church that's come up that they have a question about, all the main processing is happened at that meeting, and the leaders of that meeting then take those suggestions to the leaders of the church. And they found that it's worked very well. Because people are often, I think, isn't this true across the board? We're more comfortable of sharing what we really think with those people we don't think are going to condemn us or tell us, well, I'm not going to talk to you anymore. So that's how it's been working there. When we moved to Sioux Falls, we went from being part of a house church of 50 to 60 people to be part of one of the largest Lutheran churches in the ALC. It's 4,000 members. And I mean, it's incredible. But our support group all goes to that church. So we consider, in many ways, our support group to be more the functioning church for us. And that's where we do we have worship together. We get together and pray and sing together, and we do things with our families together. And I know for some people it seems isolationist, and we have opened it up for new people to join. But we find that if everything is open to everybody, then something is lost. When you have your family times, don't you ever feel sometimes like you want to guard and hold that time precious that you have with those people that you feel comfortable with and care about? And so that, at least in Minneapolis with the church, those support groups, people aren't allowed to just come in and join those. You know, you become part of the church, become a part of the life of the church, then you join a group. And people just don't visit, you know. There's something that holds sacred to that. And I think personally that there's something good about that. There's something that becomes bad about it when it becomes ingrown and you're not open to change and you're not having that outward movement. I don't know if any of you have ever read the book by Elizabeth O'Connor, Journey Inward, Journey Outward, but that seems to be a fact that you first have to take that journey inward before you are able to have the strength to give outward. But any more comments, or you had your hand raised?
Well, the support group that was really most meaningful to me in my life was when my husband accepted a transfer clear across from California to Pennsylvania.
Oh.
And I was expecting our first child away from my entire family.
Oh.
And it was a small congregation that we became a part of, but there were a number of young mothers who were former professional women who were at home now with their children, and we got together for a Bible study originally, and it stayed a Bible study basically, but we got off onto a lot of this support, you know, with comparing our children and reinforcing each other's thoughts about how we're going through babyhood with them and all. And we brought our children in the morning to someone's house. We alternated homes. And one of us then would take the children to another room and have activities with them or whatever. That was really helpful to me because I felt so helpless, really, being so far away from home. And not knowing what I'm doing with this baby. It was really...
Which was a function historically that you know, you had the three different generations there, and you had the teaching going on, and you had someone who said, well, this, you know, it was all happening within the extended family that lived together, and now that that's broken down, it's very hard. Another element that I didn't mention yet, but wanted... Some people call recession, and people who are, they say, if it's a recession if you're not hit directly, it's a depression if you've lost your job, you know. So people who are seeing that for everybody to own their own washer, their own dryer, their own lawnmower, their own all of these things is getting ridiculous.
You can't afford it.
You can't afford it. And so what we do in our neighborhood is that we share a lawnmower. And we share garden space, And there's a large garden plot on the Augustana campus, and buy and rent the land jointly and work the land. And finding that something happens when you start sharing things economically, it seems to be just a pattern that then you're sharing yourself, you're sharing something. There's something about the American, when you enter a person's home, you're entering something very personal to them. And when you're sharing part of what you have put in economically, I have seen, at least in my experience, you're tied to that person in a way. And this is, if nothing else, this is a trend that I hope I can really see happening within the church, of having cooperatives within local churches for people who perhaps could afford their own washer, even if they could afford it, all these their things, but couldn't that money be directed in other avenues that would be much more useful? For a mother who has two young children, maybe she needs her own washer and dryer. I mean, I'm using my washer every day. But for, let's say, a bunch of single people who maybe wash once a week, or in our community there's a group of farmers, and each one of the farmers have bought one piece of the large machinery, let's say $50,000 piece of machinery. And what it turns out then is they have to work their fields together at harvest, but they're not in debt as deeply as some of the other farmers. And there's also that sense of solidarity, which farmers definitely need. I mean, that's going to be the salvation of the farmer if they can get together before we have the numbers get so low that we form a cartel. But it's an example, you know, that we have part of the American dream that I think is no longer going to be available to my generation is that everybody's going to own their own home. And in some areas, like I suppose California, that's more open to these kinds of things, I know it's happening in Minneapolis, there's new ideas that everybody doesn't have to own their own home, but maybe we could have a duplex that's bought, you know, that is bought together. Maybe you have you buy a piece of land and have some creative types of things happening. In our neighborhood that we lived in Minneapolis, there was an apartment building that was bought cooperatively. And these weren't people that were connected, but they made investment into the apartment building together. The upkeep was split between the different people who lived there, and economically it was for people who couldn't even think about buying a home. And so these are trends that I'm really hoping that will emerge. And the church needs to be the forerunner in this, because we are calling ourselves the body of Christ. And what does the body of Christ mean? I feel that we've spiritualized it so much that we have forgotten the nuts and bolts that it says that, you know, some people are an ear, some people are an eye, some people are a nose, feet. Well, maybe that does have to do with spiritual ideas as well, but it seemed to me, and you can bear me out in this if this is right, but the Hebrew people didn't have a dichotomy between the spirit and the body. I think they must have had some very grassroots meaning to that too. Maybe one person's a carpenter, maybe one person is a mason, but you work together. We can't all be these self-sufficient people. I think that as a woman, women today, I think, are under an incredible pressure to be a housewife, to be the career person, to be the community, to be involved in the community. One person can't do all of those things. And I'm part of one thing, just very on a very practical level, I'm part of a babysitting co-op. And it's a wonderful, I mean, it's fantastic, because Daryl and I have chosen to live on one income right now, and so we can't afford babysitters very often. We have a babysitting co-op that doesn't involve any money. It involves all hours, and it's marvelous. It's fantastic. Women who join it, it's kind of like, you know, if you get sold on a product, it keeps selling. Well, that's how this idea has gone. Or a play group, you know, where you have maybe one taking turns. One woman takes care of the children one day a week, and and but your children are getting group experience together, but connected to a family. It's not something that's what I love about my babysitting co-op. They're not just having some person who doesn't care about them take care of them. They're having a family that's taking care of them, which, I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, I didn't want you to.
No, okay, that's fine.
Okay. I find Jenny, the model that you described very, very exciting and helpful. I think because it really is combining what are tested values of our faith and mm-hmm. tradition with a courage to try to move in new directions to redress problems that have continued to plague us, and certainly that lonely individual, in spite of being within community, is a terrible problem. And I find women, with the help of feministic insights, really moving our tradition in good new directions. But I really do feel the men left out of this.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd like to address that again from a slightly different angle and on the basis of some observation. I do think that males, because of the way we're conditioned, are not capable of that intimacy of sharing usually.
Mm-hmm.
That's the reason for our associating on the basis of goal-oriented projects. There may be, because it's not conspicuous, we can broach the question of personal concern mm-hmm. as we're building a house or fishing or meeting at a prayer breakfast. But what I've observed in the circle that my wife is associated with, and she would share this, so I'm not broaching privacy, is that the women have suffered also because of the inability of husbands to relate intimately on levels of personal concern. They have this image of the macho who just is self-sufficient, and hence mm-hmm. the woman's need to share is not satisfied within the marriage. And what has happened within a circle that grew within our church, was supported by our church, and was comprised of all church women, was this. A group of women experienced such levels of sharing there that it really called their marriages into question.
Exactly.
And the result was several lesbian alliances which broke the marriages of their primary marriages. And it was such a thing that the pressure within the group became primarily in the direction of lesbian relationships. Mm-hmm. And finally, my wife said, "This is not for me," and she got out. One of those now drawn into that and having broken her marriage is our pastor's wife.
it must have rocked the church.
Well, it has. And fortunately, another assistant pastor, a female pastor, and her lawyer husband held the church together in the meantime. So there is another side of this, which
yes.
is very sordid and very threatening, but it does involve the inability of males, I think, to engage in this kind of sharing, which leave females lonely. But I think now females who have not recognized with courage some lessons which have come from our society, namely that the traditional pattern of family predicated on male-female heterogeneous marriages is a dominant value,
mm-hmm.
That homosexuality, at least in most cases, is not a lasting value that will mm-hmm. sustain life, because life involves promulgation.
Mm-hmm.
This particular woman does have children. She's going to have to come out someday because she now is seeking a permanent. She's been through two impermanent lesbian relationships that haven't worked. She's seeking a permanent one and doing that rather openly. You don't know the situation, so I think it's safe to share this.
Yes.
You'll never meet this person. But to me, that raises the question of promiscuity, as this
yes.
person is openly in the congregation seeking a mate.
Yeah.
And she's seeking some of our wives.
Yeah.
It gets very, very tough. Now, I broach that as a question which is not
yes.
unknown to feminism.
Yes.
The problem of this level of sharing threatening what I regard as a very important and essential institution both to the church and to society. Do you have anything to share on that?
Oh, I think it's very interesting you said that, because this summer has brought something out for Daryl and I, is that that's really what happened to Daryl and I, was we found that I was sharing so intimately with these women that then Gerald would, I would come home and he'd say, well, what did you share? And I said, well, you know, a lot of what we share, we consider sacred to the group, and we do not share it outside, and even with our husbands, some of the things. He was feeling very left out. And I was also finding that I wasn't sharing with him. I didn't feel the need as much, because I thought, well, I'm having these people who understand me. And we find that sometimes, for Gerald and I sharing, we have to get all over all these female-male things where Gerald's not understanding what I'm talking about. And we really had to address that. And we found that when he became part of a support group and he started sharing, then he would come and share. He could share with me what was going on with him, and I could share what was going on with me. Maybe not exact with the group, but it was when he began to share more intimately that it was really starting to free up for us, because Daryl was raised in a family where, you know, he never saw his parents fight in his whole life. So that is a kind of an indication that you were not to share, you know, your insides. He was raised with that, you know. You know, Norwegian, stiff upper lip, you know, go forward. And that was very hindering for him. So our breakthrough was when he became in touch with some of his hurts. So I don't know, but that's a fascinating issue, because, so what do we, my question now is, what do we say to the men if they cannot start in having a group that would be defined as a sharing group? Would it be more likely and more helpful to draw in men to have something that would be, at least outwardly at first, a study around the scriptures, a study around, you know, going fishing together?
I think that's very important that the group not not threaten, that it does indicate that it supports the
yes.
marriages and the men.
Yeah. Right.
And draws them in
that's
on some
exactly.
level.
Yes.
Right. That's what I was going to say. And to affirm, yeah, within the group of women, to affirm the importance of each one's marriage and
yeah.
relationship.
Yeah.
Right. That's
because
why we started doing things as families.
Because it can be threatened. And to affirm the differences, it's just a fact that those differences are unique. And
oh,
sometimes
yes.
they cause frictions between the woman and the man in the marriage. And
right.
that can be a creative thing, too, if it's viewed that way, if it's accepted.
And that's where doing things, where it really started to blossom was we started to have evenings where we would get together around, you know, someone's fireplace with wine and cheese and mm-hmm. the couples. And oh, it was wonderful. We had a wonderful time. And then we went one step farther and started to include the whole family. And we have periodic picnics, and at Christmas we have, other than the church calendar events, we have our very intimate services together as families. And that has been a real drawing in of the husbands. I know that one of the husbands has said to his wife that he cherishes those times so much. And right before we left, a few days before we left, they had a going away party for us, and it was the husbands and the wives, and we had a prayer together. It would just spontaneously happen that we had a time of prayer together. And there was such a feeling that I think is really meant probably by God originally for the family, but it was such a family caring time. It was like, we are sending you out we're sending you out with love, and we're sending you out with our care. And that was wonderful, because it wasn't isolating then. It was as you said, which I really like, I hadn't thought of it, but we were supporting things that have been tested through time, the family. Mm-hmm. And that was basically what we were trying to recreate.
And you were empowering the man.
Yeah.
You know, men are very threatened today. Mm-hmm. They see women doing exciting things and discovering their power. And women have a lot of power. You know, they have earth power. They have propagated power. And men are seeing how thin they are.
And if women who have all of this power reinforce that feeling, it has all kinds of bad results. Mm-hmm. And the man can quickly become depotentized.
Mm-hmm.
Sterility, of course, impotency, I mean, really is an increasing factor in our society. And so I think what you have then is the man is diminished. And then the women who are feeling this power begin to look on the men as unworthy.
Mm-hmm.
And to create relationships of strength, they have to turn to other women.
Mm-hmm.
And again, it just gets leads to the scenario that I described.
Right.
So for the women group to attend to that and to try to empower rather than to disembowel or...
And draw in.
You
had wanted to say something.
Is there a difference in regions? The Midwestern type of life would be different than the Eastern
mm-hmm.
or the Western.
Yeah.
So that if you get a region or a community that's too diversified in area, there could be a problem also.
I think it's the extremes of the continent. If you go to Southern California, I think you'll find a situation similar to ours. But these are situations, that's right, that are very heterogeneous, where there no longer is a definable tradition to carry the culture.
Mm-hmm.
And hence experimentation really dominates the scene.
And Sioux Falls mm-hmm. is like, I consider 5 years back in how the values that are very strong in that town. It's a family town, and it might be 80,000, but it's comprised mainly of farmers. And then our community that we were part of for all those years is in Minneapolis, and Minneapolis is stuck in the Midwest, but it really represents what's going on both coasts. I always say Minneapolis wants to be New York. You know, Sioux Falls wants to be Minneapolis, and Minneapolis wants to be New York. You know, Minneapolis, the neighborhood we lived in on our block, we had a large transvestite community, a large gay community, lots of wealthy prostitutes. It wasn't the street types of prostitution, but it was the more wealthy types of prostitution. We had spiritualists. We had two large houses of people coming out of the state institution. It was a wild place. And so, it really was, but there were still these things going on. But I think that I don't even think we thought about it, but one thing that I think is a key I hadn't thought about before was that we drew the family in immediately. So we weren't isolating the women, and we were saying, this is our group, but also acknowledging that our children and our our husbands were part of this support group as well, even though maybe they weren't meeting in the intimate circle of the things that we were sharing, and we didn't share those things at those gatherings. But I think one of the things that I have enjoyed the most is that my children, since I don't have any aunts or uncles, for my kids in my neighborhood and in my community, to have these people in my support group who care about my kids and like here, send postcards, my son gets postcards, from these people. And that's important, because that's what we need. I think we need to, don't we all have the need to know that someone cares about us and knows where we are? Maybe we didn't like that when we were in high school, but I like having someone care about what I'm doing and where I'm going and if I'm having a problem with something.
I think you'd find that more likely in rural communities.
Mm-hmm.
But the rural people had to depend on each other for many things.
And also you said mm-hmm. that in the rural communities you have the extended family is more there.
Right.
Like, my father's not an emotional person, but him and two of his brothers farm really close together, and I know they share things back and forth when they're helping each other with the field work.
Mm-hmm.
And we didn't socialize a lot as families, because the men all worked together, and different things that would happen, my mom said she knew that they were sharing things with each other.
Mm-hmm. They had their support group out there in the field, when they were having their 10 o'clock coffee and rolls.
Yeah. Or whenever, she said a lot of times if she'll go someplace to find my dad or something, she said he's almost always with his brothers,
mm-hmm.
Though we don't socialize as families.
Well, to a large degree the type of machinery that the farmers had years ago, such as threshing machines, mm-hmm. shredders, silage cutters, and so forth, made the sharing of labor necessary.
Yeah.
Then the combine, the things like that came in, where a farmer could, at that time, the combines weren't very expensive yet, they could buy them and use them on their own. I'm old enough, I mean my early 50s, so that type of sharing with the shredders and threshers and so forth existed up until in the early 50s yet. Yeah. And now you say, now this is because of the expense of the machines now. Combines can cost up to $100,000.
Oh, yeah.
Tractors more than that and so forth. They're again going back to that, but for a different reason. Then.
Right, and it's interesting that I can remember going out and detasseling. You know, we'd all be sitting there all together. I mean, they would hire a whole, I mean, as many kids as they could get to do that. And that was a type of community type of thing. Well, that's not, you know, they've got the machines now. And to me, this is another basic question that ties into what I think is inappropriate technology. Do we consider appropriate technology to be energy and cash intensive or people intensive? People need jobs, and particularly in the third world, they don't need a $100,000 tractor that perhaps will get in there and harvest the grain quicker. They've got all of these people that need to be doing that. And I think that this, to me, ties in with the whole idea of that we are not dichotomized types of people, that we can separate our job from who we are, and all these things come together, and that we have a need. To me, it's evident in that now people who used to be willing to just move across the country with their company now are saying, we want to stay where we're at, because we're more than just corporate executives who want to get ahead, but we're people who are connected to other people. And to me, that draws right back to the idea of the body of Christ. And Magali Rodriguez Mossman, who was here last week, who just kind of blew my head away. If you can listen to any of their tapes, I would highly recommend it. She said, you know, we're multi-channeled people. We don't have one channel that you turn on and then we meet all our needs with that one channel, but we're multi-channeled. We have so many different needs, and we can't meet them all. One person can't meet all of your needs, and you can't meet all your own needs. And for me, first of all, I have to go to God to experience that longing and fulfillment on a deep level that no person can fulfill. But I had a friend of mine tell me once that God, greatest gift to us is each other, and we need to cherish that gift and use that gift and become to get to know each other. And I think Holden is a beautiful place where people can have a taste of that, at least on a beginning basis, to be living, eating, working, playing together, and not have the car that you can zoom off or have the telephone you can get on, that kind of, Daryl finds telephones totally grating, because he says, someone can call me on the phone and I can be having an intimate conversation and just block in right there. And so a lot of times he won't answer his telephone as well. But is it about time, I thought?
That's about 20 minutes to.
Oh, it's 20 minutes to. Do we have any other questions or comments?
My concern with support groups doesn't go quite as far as ending up with a homosexuality thing. But even in the group that we sort of trying to get going in church, I find them so often destructive to marriage and the family. Because what can be an everyday annoyance of just human nature things is shared in the support group, and someone in there eventually, you know, get rid of your husband, or, you know, you shouldn't have to put up with socks on the floor, whatever. The little things become so large, and I have a real concern with that. And I have thought maybe one of the answers would be support groups of couples starting out together, because you naturally gravitate male-female within that context anyway. Mm-hmm. Do you have any experience with?
Well, in our church in Minneapolis, it's couples. That's how it is. I mean, the couples are not split up.
And
so it wasn't women and then the men.
No. It's all not the support group I'm part of now.
This is a geographic one.
Yes, this is the one in the geographic areas, and it's the families. And they found it very empowering. In fact, I was in Minneapolis right before, I go back fairly often, and I was at one of the women's house, and she said how it was so helpful for her with her support group, for she and her husband, because they were thinking of immigrating to Israel. He teaches English as a second language, and she said the whole support group was part of that, helping them work through not only just the problems of what it was going to mean for them to move to Israel, but helping them pack, helping them with childcare, so that they could go out and, you know, do the immigration things. And they found that it was so wonderful to be together as a family in that, and having other families help them work through that. So that was one example that comes to my mind specifically that was empowering to a family rather than splitting apart. I know that Daryl found it very, in our support group, this was going on when we lived there, and in our community house. Our community house was big enough that our community house comprised our whole support group. And they could tell when something was going on with us, and that was very threatening sometimes. And to have your marriage that open to other people sometimes is very threatening, and you feel very vulnerable. And if a certain person thought another person, you know, I mean, like I can remember as clear as day one time someone saying, "Daryl, you're really treating Jenny badly," or something in this particular instance. It didn't have the effect I thought it would be. It made him angry and made him withdraw, you know. And he realized later that he was not open to that kind of invasion.
Well, men aren't allowed to lose.
Yeah.
That's another ingredient in what we're sensing here, the inability of men to engage on that level. He's not allowed to lose in a marriage.
Mm-hmm.
He's got to be a fulfilling husband, nurturing husband. And that, of course, comes out of the society and economics. We're not allowed to lose there. And that defines the conversation of males oftentimes. You know, how's your stock doing compared to mine? What's your last promotion? I mean, God forbid that you should have lost your job and be unemployed.
Yes.
Women, in large part, haven't been co-opted by society in that manner. And hence, they're able to share real feelings and be human beings rather than cogs in this grand economic mechanism. Now, the question is whether that'll continue as women are drawn into the professions. And I think there's a great danger there that that's going to be lost.
Mm-hmm.
You know, our agenda is programmed by our society.
Mm-hmm.
And I certainly can't exclude myself in the least in saying that my inability to relate to fellow males is largely because of being programmed by my society and its expectations of me.
That you compete with other men.
We compete. That's how we relate. We compare notes.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And isn't it interesting then to me, as you say that, to say that then the number one thing that has come out of Daryl's support group is sharing fears.
Yeah, that's marvelous. That's really where the need is.